for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. There is a feeling today among too many Americans that we might not make it. That's how Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig begins his new book titled Republic Lost. He argues the root cause of the nation's problems is the corrupting influence of money on politics. Lawrence Lessig joins me in the studio. His new book is titled Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Lawrence Lessig is professor of law at Harvard University Law School, director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to see you.
Good morning. It's great to be back.
You recently published a letter in the Huffington Post to the Occupy Wall Street protesters. What did you say to them?
Well, I was trying to argue and hope persuade the protesters to make sure that their protest speaks to the wide audience that could be behind them. I fear that the protest is focused too much as if it's a fight against the rich, when it needs to be a fight against those who use their privilege to corrupt the system and the system which has produced the regulation which led to the collapse on Wall Street and the collapse of our economy. So Wall Street's a perfect place for their protest because Wall Street is an extraordinary location of influence being used both before 2008 to buy deregulation, but more dramatically after 2008 to avoid re-regulation. So it's a great place to focus their protest. But we need to have a protest that could bring in the left and the right. And I think the focus on the corrupting influence of money in our system is a chant which people on the left and the right could join.
And right now you feel it's going in just one direction instead of, as it should be, more broadly.
I think it's wonderfully ambiguous right now. I think it's an extraordinary movement. And I've seen, I visited the Wall Street protest. I spent a couple days going to that. And I'm actually doing a teach-in here in the K Street protest this afternoon. So I'm not criticizing at this point, but I'm trying to get people to recognize that though many of us are liberal, and I consider myself a liberal, the place where we could find agreement is not convincing everybody of our liberal views. The place we could find agreement is about convincing people that the system that we have right now for governing our nation has been corrupted. So we don't have to have a common end, but we do have a common enemy, I think. And a common enemy is a system for funding campaigns that has led this Congress to be deeply corrupted from what our framers expected they would be.
You call this dependence corruption. Explain what you mean.
Well, when people think about corruption, they typically think of Rob Blagojevich or Randy Duke Cunningham kind of corruption, a quid pro quo violation of the law. And that, of course, is an important kind of corruption. But actually, our Congress has almost none of that. This is probably the cleanest Congress in the history of Congress. These are not criminals that we're talking about. These are decent people who come to Washington for the right reason, whether you agree with their reason or not. The kind of corruption that we have in Washington is the wrong dependency that they've developed. The framers of our Constitution, in giving us a representative democracy, imagined, as Federalist 52 put it, a branch that would be, quote, dependent upon the people alone. But our Congress is not dependent upon the people alone. People who spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money obviously have a different kind of dependency, a dependency upon the funders. And the funders are not the people. You know, I think that the Occupy Wall Street people need to adjust their signs. It's not the 99%. It's the 99.95% of Americans who never max out in their contributions to even one campaign who we need to be worrying about. Because, of course, candidates pay attention to the people who max out to their campaign. And 0.05% of Americans max out to anybody in a political campaign. So when you spend your life raising money from the funders, and the funders represent 0.05% of America, obviously you're going to bend your attention and bend your policy in a way that focuses on them and not on the people. And that is a kind of corruption.
What about the recent Supreme Court decision on this very issue?
So the Supreme Court, in two decisions in the last 3 years, Citizens United and in the Arizona case just this last term, has made it clear that Congress can't limit independent expenditures of either individuals or corporations, independent of political campaigns. And they've also limited the way in which public funding might remedy some of the problems that are created by privately funded elections. So in the Arizona case, they struck down a triggering mechanism which allowed you to get more public funding depending on what your opponent was actually spending. But both of them are troubling decisions. But I still think that the solution to the problem that we face right now, we could enact without actually amending the Constitution. The independent expenditure one is really an extraordinarily difficult problem because, as we're seeing, the Supreme Court assumed that all these independent expenditures were going to be transparent. But as Stephen Colbert has so wonderfully taught the nation through his super PAC, in fact, there is no transparency requirement in these super PACs. And some of the largest super PACs have extraordinary amounts of effectively anonymous contributions that are being made to these super PACs. And these super PACs are ostensibly independent of campaigns. But so cumbersome is the independence that Karl Rove's super PAC has now asked the FEC to relax some of the independence requirements because it's too difficult for them to maintain their effective independence. So I think everybody is recognizing that these are essentially arms of campaigns. And as they are arms of campaigns, they are raising precisely the corruption concern that the Supreme Court denied that they would raise.
Aren't you talking about capitalism as a whole and as we know it?
No, I'm not. I'm a son of a capitalist. I'm a believer in free markets. I'm not against capitalism, even though I understand some of my brothers occupying Wall Street and occupying K Street are. I'm an opponent of crony capitalism. I'm an opponent of a capitalism that uses its power not to innovate in the marketplace, but to come to Washington and buy special privilege and protection from competition in the marketplace. I stand with libertarian economists such as Luigi Zingales from the University of Chicago, who with co-author wrote a book, Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists, which is emphasizing the way in which every generation of successful capitalists who made their wealth in a free market eventually turn around to Washington and try to get from Washington protection from the next generation of successful capitalists. So the problems we have right now, in my view, are not about capitalism. It's about capitalism corrupted. And it's about that corruption infecting the political system so that they depend upon each other so tightly that the real competitors, the real free marketeers out there, can't even compete against the burden that's been imposed upon them by this corruption.
So your solution might be public funding of political campaigns.
Right, although of a particular kind. So, you know, we could think of a family of solutions out there as the small dollar funded election solutions, the kind of solution that Arizona, red state Arizona has, red blue state Maine has, blue state Connecticut has. My particular version of this small dollar funded elections says that every one of us gives at least $50 to the federal treasury. So take that first $50 and turn it into a democracy voucher. And then say to candidates that you can accept, you can get the democracy voucher from anybody in the country, so long as you agree to take only democracy vouchers plus contributions of up to $100. I take $100 from Buddy Romer, my hero in the Republican campaign. So that means that candidates could opt into a system where they take no more than $100 from any individual, no PAC money, and they get these democracy vouchers to fund their campaigns. Now, $50 to every voter is $6 billion in an election cycle.
Plenty.
Yeah. The last congressional election had $1.8 billion. So this is 2.5 times the amount from the last congressional election. And so it's real money. And if done right, candidates would have a real reason to opt into the system where they could get these democracy vouchers rather than spending all their time sucking up to the 0.05% of America that gives them the max contributions to fund their campaigns.
You must have been disappointed then when initially there was talk that what President Obama, then candidate Obama, was planning was to take public funding and then changed his mind.
I was disappointed then. I was much more disappointed after the election. You know, look, I was a friend of Obama. He was a colleague of mine at Chicago. I supported every single one of his campaigns from the very beginning, even the losing campaigns. But I think the only reason the world had for supporting Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton was that Barack Obama said his reason for running was to, quote, take up the fight to change the way Washington works, constantly focused on the way in which this system had been corrupted, and that corruption was what we had to change. Hillary Clinton, to her credit, said, look, it's not my job to fix the horse. It's my job to get on the horse and run it as far as I can. So when Americans chose Hillary versus Barack, it was about this issue. But when he became president, all of this reform disappeared, and he became the president of the status quo.
Lawrence Lessig. He is professor of law at Harvard University. His new book is titled Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Welcome back. We're going to open the phone shortly for Professor of Law Lawrence Lessig of Harvard University. His new book, which on the cover has the United States Capitol and its dome covered in dollar bills. His new book is titled Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. When you think about money and its corrupting process, does it defeat both the left and the right, or does it work to the benefit of one versus the other?
One of the most proud moments in the writing of this book was when a colleague of mine read it and he said, "You sound like a right winger in writing the book." And I was proud of that because I think the most important message I'm trying to convey is that this is not an issue that the left alone should care about. Of course the left should care about it. We've seen in this administration how issues that are particularly sensitive to the left, global warming or healthcare, have been affected by this. But it's the right as well that needs to worry about this issue. The right that fundamentally has policy objectives that cannot be achieved so long as we have this system of funding campaigns. So, for example, think about the recent proposal by Herman Cain for a 999 tax plan. The biggest thing that would do is to completely destroy the industry inside of Washington that essentially sells special tax benefits in exchange for enormous amount of lobbying dollars and campaign contributions. The Wall Street Journal in December of last year had this piece about the explosion of these temporary tax provisions, as they called them, these extenders that require repeated reauthorization every couple of years. And they were puzzled. Why is there this business of temporary tax provisions? Well, the answer is, when you have a temporary tax benefit, as that's expiring, the congressman has somebody to call and say, you need that research and development tax credit. We're going to need a lot of support down here to make sure that we get it. And so there's an industry designed to flush money into the system so that if you're a tax reformer and you want simple taxes or flat taxes or whatever you want, you're not going to get it so long as Congress depends upon the complexity as a means to fund their campaigns.
You talked before the break about President Obama, what he said he wanted to do, what he has or has not been able to do since taking office. Is it because, exactly as you describe, the system itself is so entrenched that no one can go up against it and clearly make a change without, as you suggest, a constitutional convention?
Well, I think 4 years ago, I would have said no one could come up against it. On January 20th, 2009, I thought there was one person who could come up against it. I thought Obama was that person. I thought the nation was united in a way that it hadn't been in such a long time, and reform was at the core of that union. We have to remember, Obama was the first Tea Party member. He was the reformer in chief. And when he spoke on January 20th, there was the sense that he could do anything. But what's absolutely clear, and you get this from talking to people inside the administration and from reading about the administration as it developed, they had no plan for how they were going to, as Obama said, quote, take up the fight to change the way Washington worked. They found themselves in the middle of a crisis. And indeed, one senior administration official said to me, well, what could we do? We are in the middle of a crisis. But the point was, it is only in the middle of a crisis that you can get the nation to focus on the need to fundamentally reform the system. It's told to me that Obama, when he got his first budget, there were some 7,000 earmarks in the budget. And Obama's first instinct was to say, I want to veto this bill. And then his lobbyists told him, no, you can't veto this bill. You can't burn the bridges with the Democratic Congress. If he had vetoed that bill, there would have been a radically different trajectory for this administration. He would have been understood as the man who is standing up to this corrupt system. And the enemy would not have been the Republicans. The enemy would have been this corruption. And I think the nation, as we are seeing, the nation has enormous energy to rally around real change, would have rallied around that president to the end of ending that corruption.
Have you been able to speak with him personally?
I have not spoken to him personally since Elena Kagan was nominated to the Supreme Court. I was a friend of Elena, so I got to watch that process and saw him briefly in that process. But I've not spoken to him about this. After I wrote a piece in The Nation, which originally was going to be titled The Tyranny of Tiny Minds, but people thought that was a little bit too aggressive. Many of my friends in administration didn't consider me a friend anymore, and so I've not been part of what happened in the administration, even though I was a strong supporter and campaigner for Obama before.
Is it too late?
You know, I would love to figure out a way that this man could reclaim the mantle of reform. I would love to find a way to imagine him thinking to himself, this is the thing I promised to do, and this is the thing we have to do. But I frankly don't see the path. I think it, you know, he is Lucy, we are Charlie Brown. Once again, the ball has been pulled and we have fallen flat on our back.
How do you think our representatives and senators actually spend their days?
I think they spend, and we don't have good numbers on this, and I read every single estimate that tried to calculate this, but they spend an enormous amount of their time focused on this problem. How do I raise the money I need, not just for my own campaign, but to pay the taxes that I have to pay to my party so that the party has enough money to try to win back control of Congress. So the estimates are anywhere from 30 to 70% of their time in this bizarre-like ritual where they race up to Capitol Hill in response to this bell, like a recess bell from elementary school, to vote in a way that, you know, procedural votes. They don't know exactly what they're voting on until they get there and their staffer tells them what to do. And then they race off the hill into these cubby holes, cubbies, where they sit there with headsets and a speaker system set up so that they can race through the calls of people they've never even met to try to raise money from them to fund their campaigns. It's crazy making. And, you know, if you compare what our Congress looks like today to what the framers envisioned and actually lived, where congressmen went to their desk at 10 o'clock in the morning and sat there for 6 hours listening to the debates of others, deliberating. We don't have anything like that today. You know, you could look at our Congress compared to the British House of Commons. The British House of Commons looks a lot like what the framing looked like, right? Where they actually argue and debate and deliberate. That's what we imagined a Congress for. There's no reason to be sitting here in Washington if all you're doing is raising money so that you can get back to Washington.
How did you personally become so inspired to get this kind of message out?
Well, I had spent many years working in the area of internet and copyright policy. The first time I was on your show, I was talking about a book in that area. And what I found after spending about 10 years working in this field was that though people were getting the point, parents and educators and business people were getting the point about the need for a different kind of copyright policy, I'd come to Washington and it was as if nobody had ever even heard the other side of the issue. And, you know, this is one of those moments where I realized I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. I recognized, well, it's obvious nobody here hears the issue because this side of the issue doesn't have all the money in the world behind it. Mm. And so, again, a moment of recognizing not so smart as you thought, I recognized it wasn't just esoteric questions like copyright policy, but it was fundamental questions like global warming or every single issue where Congress can't get to the right issue and answer to the question because it's blocked by all the money in the world that wants to stop it or preserve the status quo in one particular way or the other. So I thought, look, I have tenure at a great university. I've written 5 books about this. I think an academic should throw away all his intellectual capital every 10 years and start all over again. So I said I was going to throw it away and start all over again here.
You know, we were just in the earlier program talking about this tar sands pipeline from Canada to Mexico, the money that's going into that is one of those issues that makes you wonder whether the people in Nebraska, whose land this could cross, the people in Nebraska beneath whose aquifer could be direly affected, whether they will have a voice.
That's right. And the way you put it was precisely right. The money makes us wonder. The money makes us skeptical about whether the answer is the right answer. Look, we're not all experts, right? We don't have time to focus on hard public policy questions. We hire our representatives to do that for us. And when you start seeing the representatives dancing with people who have enormous amounts of money that they're trying to use to influence them one way or the other, you can't help but wonder. So 75% of Americans in a poll that was conducted for this book believe money buys results in Congress. A little bit more Democrats than Republicans, but I guarantee you when the Democrats controlled Congress, more Republicans than Democrats. And that view leads to an extraordinary lack of confidence in this institution. So whether it's 11% or 12%, 12% of Americans have confidence in Congress. There were more people who believed in the British crown at the time of the Revolution than who believe in our Congress today. At what point does an institution have to declare political bankruptcy? Because I think if there is such a line, 12% crosses it many times over.
Do you really believe it's time to call for a constitutional convention?
I think that the framers envisioned exactly this problem. They thought if Congress is the problem. We need to give away for us to amend the Constitution without depending on Congress. So Article 5 says the states can call for a convention to propose amendments, and Congress can propose amendments on its own. It's clear this Congress is not going to change itself, not going to cure itself. It needs an intervention, like an alcoholic needs an intervention. And I think the convention could be that intervention.
Lawrence Lessig of Harvard University, his new book titled Republic Lost. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Good morning, Richard. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Diane. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lessig, also, I saw him the other night on TV, very impressed with what he had to say. I'm part of a small grassroots organization here in New Jersey called Citizens Against Campaign Excesses. And we are trying to get together a program whereby we get taxpayer money. We figure it would be $1 a year from all taxpayers to support a political cable channel that would also include a website. And it would essentially cut the politicians off at the knees. All political campaigning, that includes from these outside groups, the PACs and so on, would be put onto the political cable channel. And people would be able to see the politicians present their points of view, their platforms, their debates, and by way of the political cable channel and the website. And we just think also that it would give the electorate more of a chance to get less apathetic towards voting, because they would realize that the politicians would really then really be able to represent the constituents' needs and not the needs of the deep pockets.
What do you think of that idea?
Well, so it's similar to what most mature democracies do in setting up easy access of candidates to the public through essentially free media. And that's important. And I think it would be a fine part of any package of reform. But I think that it doesn't quite yet get to what the core problem here is, which is if candidates are in the business of needing to raise enormous amounts of money, regardless of the fact that they also get free TV, they still will be competing and raising enormous amounts of money. They are going to become dependent upon their funders. And so long as the funders are not the people, as long as the funders are the 0.05% of us rather than all of us, they will steer their policy away from the policy that reflects the people. And that will continue to drive the cynicism that I think is at the core of this corruption.
Here's an email from Denisha in Florida who says, I agree with your guest about the transience of the Occupy Wall Street movement. It is appealing to a broad spectrum of the American public. I feel this particular moment in time is going to result in a reconstruction of the American political system.
Let's hope so. It's going to take a lot more than we've seen so far, and it's going to take a lot more bridge building to the other side, so that I think the Occupy movements have got to begin to invite the grassroots Tea Party people into their midst and the Coffee Party people into their midst, so that we increasingly see this union of concern around an issue everybody can agree upon. So I don't want people to compromise their values. I'm a liberal. I believe in certain things very strongly, and I don't want to give those views up. But I do think we need to agree about the structure of the system, and the structure of the system right now is corrupt, and both sides should be able to see that corruption.
To Indianapolis. Good morning, Thomas.
Hello. Thank you. I had an even more radical proposal, which is to outlaw any kind of funding altogether and just give people access, equal access to a format where they go, where they either debate and whittle down the field that way, and just have equal access for all candidates and no financing.
So that is radical. It would require a pretty radical constitutional amendment. It's similar to my friend Dylan Radican's proposal that he's been pushing on his show, the Get Money Out proposal, where he has more than 200,000 people now who have signed a petition for an amendment to the Constitution that bans any contributions by anybody, period. And I guess I find myself a little bit as a small C conservative here, which is, what's the smallest change we need to make to fix the system, recognizing there's many more radical changes we could make that might also fix the system. So I think if we're going to amend the Constitution, the amendment should just have three parts. Number one, it should say public elections must be publicly funded. Number two, it should say contributions shall be limited to $100, or the equivalent of $100. And number three, it should say Congress has the power to limit but not to ban independent expenditures by corporations or by individuals. So I think it's important not to try to ban anybody from participating, but it's also important to have a system where that participation doesn't dominate the process.
Three pretty straightforward ideas. I'll be interested in your response. 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning, more at MoMA.org. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count report provides state-level data on the well-being of kids and families at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, tracking viruses and the start of pandemics, Nathan Wolf has traveled to the viral hotspots of the world, where viruses first jump species from animal to human. His mission is to provide early alerts about deadly viruses. His new book is called The Viral Storm. Join us.
And welcome back. Lawrence Lessig is here in the studio. He's professor of law at Harvard University. His new book titled Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Here's an email from Howard who says, wouldn't it be an easier solution to simply amend the law that allows corporations to be treated as citizens with legal rights? Doing so would take away the majority of their lobbying power and remove a great deal of corruptive influence in Washington.
So there's a view of many in the reform movement that corporations being treated as persons, not as United States citizens, and the Citizens United decision, which recognized their right to spend unlimited amounts of money from their corporate treasury on independent political expenditures, are somehow the source of the problem in our democracy. That if we could go back to January 20th, 2010, the day before Citizens United was decided, we would have a perfectly well-functioning democracy. But, you know, my view is January 20th, 2010, our democracy was already broken. And it was not broken simply because corporations are treated as persons. Maybe that's part of it. But it wouldn't be fixed merely by declaring that corporations are not persons or by declaring that corporations don't have a right to engage in independent political speech. I actually believe that the decision was right in to the extent that it allowed that nonprofit corporation to use its corporate funds to support their movie about Hillary Clinton. But it was wrong to the extent it sounded like it means that there's no justification for Congress to regulate except if Congress is regulating traditional quid pro quo bribery. I think that was the error in Citizens United. And I would be happy to have citizenship as, you know, the corporate status as persons revoked in the context of an amendment that did those other three things. But I think that if you did those other three things, have publicly funded elections, have a limitation on contributions, and have the power to limit independent expenditures, the additional limitation on corporations as being persons wouldn't actually be necessary.
And Randy, post this message on Facebook. Ask your guest why he believes the Occupy Wall Street movement is so wonderful and exciting as compared to the Tea Party movement. Is he, like so many other liberals, against the Tea Party, yet for this group? Why are both groups not wonderful when they both want to limit something? The Tea Party wants limited government. The Wall Street bunch wants to limit business.
Yeah, so I'm a populist, and that means that I was extremely excited by the populist Tea Party movement. Just like I'm excited by the populist Occupy Wall Street, Occupy K Street movement. That doesn't mean that I'm a supporter of the substantive policy positions that many in the Tea Party advance. It means that I support the idea of people standing up and reclaiming their power over government. So I've actually gone to a Tea Party convention. 2,000 people, extraordinarily committed citizens, not talking about gay rights or the right to of a woman to choose to terminate a pregnancy, but talking about how do we get our government back under control. And that was a conversation I was eager to have with people because I agree that is a fundamental concern. Now, I think that we should be able to agree on what is the root cause of this underlying problem. Remember, Thoreau is my sacred text here, and he writes, for every 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil, there's one striking at the root. I think we need more root strikers here. And I think the Tea Party, the populist Tea Party, not the Washington Tea Party, but, you know, my favorite Tea Party brand is the Tea Party Patriots, which were really a populist movement, not Koch brother funded. They are a large movement of Tea Party activists who are really decentralized populist in this sense. I think those people should resonate with this concern just as much as I hope that the Occupy Wall Street people will.
And here's a caller in Newport Township, Illinois. Good morning, Jim.
Dr. Lessig, I'd like to hear some discussion about how campaign funds are utilized to preserve the Democratic Republican system and drown out everyone else. This prevents us joining the modern world by adopting a runoff election system. And this intellectual wasteland is devoid of alternative ideas and directions as long as this political duopoly is preserved.
Yeah, I think this is an extremely interesting question. And actually, this year, we're seeing enormous progress by the Americans Elect Project, which is, I think, going to succeed in having a simple way for an alternative to the two-party candidates to be on every single ballot in the 2012 election. And they have an enormous amount of resources behind them pushing for this opportunity to, as they see it, break this stranglehold of the Democrat and Republicans. I guess this is, again, in the kind of barrel of great ideas that it would be good for us to get to in the reform agenda that is the needed reform agenda for our republic. But it, again, doesn't feel to me like it's the first issue we've got to get to. So I would love to see a wider diversity of issues be able to be presented inside of our Congress and inside of our campaigns for president. But I think the core thing that's got to happen first is that we have presidents and Congress who are, to steal Buddy Romer's slogan, free to lead, free to be independent of the special interests that fund them, enough so that they can decide what to do on the basis of their principles or on the basis of what they think is right.
And to Lindy in Falls Church, Virginia, good morning.
Good morning. I was concerned when when the professor said that he supported Barack Obama over Hillary because he thought that he would really make this change. And I supported Barack over Hillary because I thought he could win. And what I think is important is that we realize the political game, that it's not easy to win, and there are very strong forces opposing liberal views and democratic ideas such as the environment and cutting down spending on wars and Medicare and all these things that are important. And right now, the jobs bill. And after 2 years, the Republicans got into Congress. So I don't think it's fair to blame Barack Obama for all this. I think he's doing a great job. I think he's on the case of everything he can possibly do.
I don't blame Barack Obama for the difficulty of playing the game that he's chosen to play. I blame him for choosing to play this game. When he runs a campaign that says that the reason I'm running, here's the quote, right? The reason I'm running for president is to challenge that system. And by that system, he's talking about the system which is run by, as he called it, the lobbyists, which both Republican and Democratic administrations have allowed to rule Washington. Like here, you know, here's another quote. If we do not change our politics, if we do not fundamentally change the way Washington works, then the problems we've been talking about for the last generation will be the same ones that haunt us for generations to come. I could go through pages and pages of his characterizing his campaign about this reform. And I can tell you, Republicans galore who have come to me as I've been out talking about this, saying, I don't believe in what Obama wanted to do with respect to global warming or healthcare, but I believed in him because I thought he was going to change the system. And the decision not even to take up that fight, I think, is the point of fair criticism. It's not that he's not been liberal enough. I didn't think he was liberal. He never was a liberal. It was that he was too conventional. He was a conventional president when he came to office promising to be a transformative president.
At the same time, he did run into a stone wall of Republicans in Congress.
I think part of the stone wall was a wall that he constructed by defining the fight as a fight between Democrats and Republicans. When America was listening for a fight about reform versus the status quo, and the status quo were problems of the Democrats as well as the Republicans. So by defining himself as the big brother Democrat, and we were going to take on the Republicans, half of America was against him from the very beginning. But if he had defined his fight as a fight against the status quo interests that are blocking reform, I think you would have seen a wide range of people rallying to his side.
Here's an email from Eunice, who says, I just finished That Used to Be Us by Thomas Friedman. Question, what do you think of his solution, i.e. a third-party candidate?
So again, I'm not against the idea of third parties, but if it's still within the system where every candidate has got to be beholden to their funders and the funders are not the people, then we're going to produce the same status quo preserving regime that we've got right now. And status quo both from the standpoint of not having reform and from the standpoint for those people on the right of not being able to shrink the size of government or simplify the taxes or get spending under control, all the things that people on the right are concerned about.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to White Pigeon, Michigan. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I want to talk about the crony capitalism, but first this despair between a Tea Party and the Wall Street. Actually, I don't think they can come together on much of anything because the Beck-inspired Tea Party says that there's nothing wrong with Wall Street, that take away all the regulations and they're fine. And this is the exact opposite of what the Wall Street people are saying. So I don't see that there's a whole lot of coordination there. But my bigger point was, you talk about the difference between capitalism and crony capitalism. And basically, it's like the old story of the scorpion running across the river on the back of the fox who led him, and then he stings him halfway across, and he asks, why are you going to do it? We're both going to die. And he says, well, you knew my nature. And isn't that the nature that as long as business and our whole capitalism system is not focused on a society-centered ideal, that this is inevitable to happen, and there's not really much you can do about it until you change the mindset of people of, you know, getting away from this idea that, you know, power is everything, and that you know, that ultimately corrupts to this point. And I'll take that question off today.
So I agree we need to recognize the nature of business and the nature of capitalists, and their nature is to make money, and they make money by innovating and finding great products that people want to buy. I think that's fine. I don't think, though, that the nature of democratic politics is that we have to allow that influence to infect our political system. We can design systems that protect the representatives from that influence in a way that allows them to be independent. Look, the framers of our Constitution were obsessed with this kind of protection. My favorite clause in the Constitution limits the ability of members of Congress to get gifts from kings or princes or any foreign state. Right? Why were they doing that? Because they didn't want them to develop the wrong kind of dependency on people who were not their constituents. And we can do the same kind of creative thinking about how to limit the influence that people who are not the people have on this Congress. And if we restored ourselves to a framing conception, which is a Congress dependent upon the people alone, and build rules to assure that dependency, I think we would make a lot of progress in keeping capitalism in its right place and keeping democracy in a very different place.
Here's a very different perspective. It was posted on our website. It says Wall Street is run by people. Corporations are owned by and employ people. You claim you want the people to make decisions, but what you really want is for the right people to make the decisions for you. I, for one, would much rather have the successful people in our country have a louder voice. The last thing we need to succeed as a nation is to have the lowest common denominator of society speak the loudest. They've proven their value to the greater good by what? Voting for and taking advantage of social welfare?
So I don't know any right-thinking capitalist who can look at the mess that Wall Street created through the gambling which they took inside of the dumbest form of socialism ever invented by man, where we socialize the risk and privatize the benefit, and look at that system and say, this is something to be proud of. You want to be proud of capitalism? Go out to the West Coast. Live in Silicon Valley the way I did. Talk to the people who are really inventing great, amazing products that make people stand up in awe. Look, you could not have an Occupy Silicon Valley movement. You would not have people standing in front of Apple Computer and saying, yeah, Steve Jobs needs to be punished for his greatness. Nobody would do that because we recognize the genius and the brilliance in what is happening out there. When you focus on Wall Street, you're focusing on a system that took advantage of the corruption of our government to build for themselves a gambling scene where they could gamble and they could get the upside and we would pay the downside. And what's worse, you know, it's one thing to say that up until 2008, they were allowed to deregulate because that was the zeitgeist. The astonishing thing is that after 2008, where every independent economist looks at this and says, no, 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 there's something wrong with a system where banks are so big that they cannot fail, yet they're allowed to gamble with our money. After 2008, Wall Street was able to blackmail Congress enough to block any fundamental reform of the system. This is not anything any capitalist should defend. And no capitalist, no self-respecting capitalist whose paycheck doesn't come from that system that I know of does defend it.
What is the one step you would like to see President Obama take now?
I want him to reclaim the statement.
How?
To take up the fight to change the way Washington works, to focus us again on what is the core problem here. The core problem is a Congress that cannot legislate independent of special interest money. Now, whether he'll be credible or not, I don't know. And I'm not even sure this is the best way for him to win his campaign. But I personally want a candidate who says we need a president free to lead. That's Romer's claim, but nobody takes him seriously because he's promised to take only $100 from any individual and take no PAC money. But I want a president who leads us to the place that we could reform the system. And it may be that this president could do it. I'd love to see him try.
Is it too late?
It might be too late for him. It might be the place that people just would not hear it. They would not believe it. They would not take it as credible. And that's the, you know, the astonishing sadness of this, that on January 20th, 2009, everybody would have believed it. And today, I don't know if they would.
Lawrence Lessig, he is professor of law at Harvard University. He's also director of the Edmund Safra Foundation Center for Ethics. There, his new book is titled Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.